While Mark Carney promised discipline, but his upcoming budget promises to blow the doors off with billions in new spending. And now, even his own MPs are grumbling. Ministers shuffled, veterans pushed aside, and the caucus whispering about who's really in charge. It's the kind of infighting that eats governments alive. And in rising debt costs, provinces crying foul, and the opposition circling, suddenly the words non-confidence vote are back on the Hill. Canadians may not have expected another election so soon, but the way this government is burning through money and loyalty, November might be closer than anyone thought. Joining me today to talk more about this, TPL's very own Paul McCucci and Jim Lang.
Hello.
Well, does Carney have a problem on his hands right now from within?
Paul?
Yeah, I think he does, right? You know, if you look at the key pillars of the government right now that he's coming against across Canada, you know, from the east to the west, he's seeing challenges. So I think what he's trying to do, he's trying to shore up his caucus and try to get people in the right place just in case. So he, you know, he's fireproofing his cabinet just in case the non-confidence does come. And I think that's based on how he's being pushed with these issues across Canada. And you see it now, you know, the shuffles, which I know, Jim, you have better handle on it than I do. But why don't you go through just how he's moving people around? And I think how he's moving people around and strategically where their foothold in Canada for votes is very important, because you see some of the strategic moves to make sure when he does announce or make the budget decision, they have enough strength in those areas to keep those votes alive.
Indeed, yeah. And in fact, it looks to me like this is only the beginning of the list.
Well, Jonathan Wilkinson's a prime example. He was a Trudeau loyalist.
Yep.
And Jonathan Wilkinson and Justin Trudeau were very tied to the hip on their mindset, you know, pro-environment, all-electric vehicles, no tankers, no pipelines. And he got moved aside as the Minister of Natural Resources. And now you have Tim Hodgson from Markham Thornhill, who is not quite as left-leaning as Jonathan Wilkinson, now is your new energy of natural resources. Okay, and so that's an interesting paradigm shift within the Liberal caucus.
It's funny because Paul made this real clear to us in our meeting. We prior to the show, we both went, well, that's true. Well, of course, we don't really need to be in the West worrying about oil or pipelines or tankers. We've made a commitment already to electric.
AV, right. So, you know, in Ontario, you know, this is the challenge right now with Stellantis in the last few days kind of telling us they're leaving. And we've already built plants, you know, with Volkswagen, Stellantis. We have nuclear plants gearing up with $39 billion in spend. We have over $50 billion in spend.
A huge amount to the grid to support this.
Right. The plants are finishing, right? So, and you know, potentially they're going to be these millions and millions of square feet empty that we're going to have to do something with. Mm-hmm. So quite frankly, we've already made the transition to EV. For those of people in Ontario, you know, that are still wondering, you know, oil, gas, you know, that ship has sailed. You know, whether or not we sell more to the US or abroad, that's another issue. But quite frankly, within Canada, it's we've made the commitment. We are all going to electric cars. There's no ifs, ands, or buts at this point.
That's true, Paul, and I don't dispute that.
Yeah.
But the infrastructure is nowhere near where it needs to be. And I interviewed Dan McTagg, and he explained detail the struggles with the infrastructure in Canada. If you drive outside of major urban areas across Canada and get into rural parts of Canada, into the Trans-Canada Highway, good luck finding a charging station.
Yeah.
It's great within Montreal and Vancouver and Calgary and Toronto because there's lots of urban charging stations. But once you get outside of that, that becomes an issue.
I don't even know if Canadians are really prepared to put a charging station in their home. So much of our populated areas are in condos.
Do we have the grid to handle it?
Or the outlets, or in fact, the finance in our bank accounts to pay for an electric car. It leads me to the, and we're not making them here in Canada, so there's no benefit to us, you know, in that market. Where are the electric cars going to come from? We're going to pay way more for them coming out of the U.S., or we're going to make a deal with another country. Let's see, who's making cars?
China?
Oh, China. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I get it. But, you know, that ship sailed, right? We're into it for $100 billion now. Yeah. There's no going back. So whether, you know, and I had this conversation with you earlier, when they made that announcement like 2 years ago, I was mortified. I was like, I fell on the floor. I'm like, this is a terrible call. Awful. Right. No one really said much. So they said, okay, great. Nothing happened. You know, they went forward. They got elected, right? That decision had been made in the Trudeau area. It went and they're past it now. So in their minds, they've, where we might be still talking about it, and I know the West Coast of Canada, you know, there's the Alberta equation and quite frankly, the fight between Alberta and BC right now with respect to running pipelines and everything. But as far as the federal government goes, this is kind of a foregone conclusion. It's done. They've spent the money. They've subsidized, you know, they sent money to Ontario to enhance nuclear plants. They've, you know, spent the money, done the deals with the auto companies in conjunction with the provinces. Yep. So that ship's gone. It's out. We're not going back. We're going to have to go forward. And quite frankly, those charging stations and all the grids and all the things we have to upgrade, that's coming in the budget somewhere. So,
but the irony is, Paul, that the prime minister and his entourage are being driven around in gas-powered SUVs and limos.
Yeah.
So he's saying that, but he's got a fleet of Chevy Suburbans with a bulletproof glass that drives him around from his residence to the airport.
Don't forget, the last guy in his position was talking about how he and his family drink from boxes. So, I mean, really engaging with the environment, I don't think is the actual reality.
But the interesting thing about this move, so back to this move with the cabinet and everything else in Markham, right? High tech.
Exactly.
Right? So you're not worried about the West Coast of Canada now. You want to be in a high tech, high investment sector because, to Jim's point, this is going to take a real push of technology to move charging stations, to move electrical grids. So this is where you got to be on the tech zone. So you don't need to refining and oil patches and all that good stuff. They're not thinking that, right? They're thinking I got to be in tech zone because I got to make this happen. So, you know, switch, okay, strategic. And also, of course, Ontario, right? Having a strong Liberal backing, right? That's where he wants to shore up his base.
Yeah, and that was one of those areas that could really swing. Markham Thornhill, there was a battle. That was a battleground.
It was an intense battle.
And so to put somebody there to actually say, okay, we're moving this agenda forward. Yeah. We're using technology.
Farm equipment is run by diesel engines, all the tractor trailers that transport the goods. We can't, I understand the need to say, get as many electric vehicles in the country as possible. But until they create the technology, we will need diesel fuel to transport goods from point A to point B. There's no way around it.
Well, I don't see anything in the spending that we've done so far that sets us up in manufacturing our own vehicles, whether it is farming or, I mean, maybe that's where we begin, where we need it to make the biggest difference. But to be honest with you, I don't see a combine. And maybe I don't understand the technology.
No.
I don't see a combine out there
running on a lithium battery.
Yeah, 3 kilometers out into the cut, and
not in the short term. I'm only going to say that to you. Not in the short term. So I think diesel has, you know, it has its life still.
Yeah.
But quite frankly, our cars, like passenger vehicles, you know, light trucks, all that good stuff, you're going to EV.
But I have a hybrid Toyota, and I swear by it. And when you brake, it charges the battery. And when you're driving along, the engine stops and the battery runs the vehicle. And we get double the mileage of a regular vehicle. So you get the best of both worlds, but they have the safety and the confidence that what if we can't plug in?
Jim,
I don't have to worry about plugging in because the engine would charge the battery.
You don't plug your car in?
No. It's a non-plug-in hybrid.
Sorry, you're going to have to move. We only have EV here. I mean, that's the problem. That's the view that we have. Is so far advanced, so much money was spent on that infrastructure, it was just to buy votes.
Well, and that, you know, that horse has left the gate, right?
I guess we're in that ride.
The election happened, and quite frankly, you know, the Liberals got in, that was their agenda, and that's where they've gone. So
another one that shocked me was the shuffle that happened in the East Coast. Some key positions were moved to different parts of the country that were really Ontario and Quebec-centric. He's shuffled those into different parts of the country.
Especially PEI, New Brunswick and Nova Scotia.
Right.
Because they lost seats in the Maritimes in the last election. And even all the political pundits were quite surprised the inroads that the Conservatives made in the Maritimes, which is historically very, very liberal.
And they're getting a lot of heat as well because the, those places are dying on the vine that are resource fortified by mining, by forestry, by fishing, all of these things that have been consistently reduced and frankly driven communities out of business.
Well, and Mike, you have people in the Maritimes now commuting 45 minutes, an hour and a half from where they live because they can afford it to where they work, which is unheard of in a lot of maritime communities that you would have a commute like that. They associate that with Vancouver, Toronto, Montreal, not in Moncton or Halifax.
I mean, I don't know what words come out of the mouths of these people now in these markets representing our government and the Liberal Party, but they have a battle on their hands still just even being there, I think.
Well, it's a national problem. We see people strung out on drugs in community parks across the country, homeless encampments across the country. There is a fear, a security fear for people with carjackings and smash and grabs and malls and home invasions that didn't exist. And they're not just in the city. They're now in the suburbs and bedroom communities in places across Canada that never experienced crime like that before.
That is true.
And you also don't forget, you have in the upcoming budget, you have a huge defense spend coming.
Yeah.
So quite frankly, the East Coast of Canada is where some of that's going to happen.
Big time.
Right? So, and the military recruitment and the basically commitment to defense has been primarily in the East Coast.
Yeah, and in the right? Well,
the Irving Shipyard in Halifax is a massive company.
Exactly. So you're going to see a boatload of money spent down on the East Coast. So quite frankly, strategically moving people or ministers into that area makes sense when you're coming into such a, again, an out of control high budget spend for a deficit. You know, you're going to say to those people, you're going to benefit because we're going to spend it on defense. So hang with us as Liberals. And that's why strategically I think it's a good move on his part. He moves a minister down there, you know, someone who has presence. He gives them comfort that there's a huge amount of government spending coming their way.
And actual attention. They've got a focus on them.
Great.
Which is a big deal.
Yeah. So it helps them.
But okay.
Shores up votes on the East Coast.
Totally agree. But Carney's run into some speed bumps along the way that maybe no one expected. Losing to the Stellantis plant in Brampton. Going down to Illinois, all of a sudden crime and safety and bail reform has become a huge issue across the country, not just in pockets. People still struggling to feed themselves. A lot of those things are issues that people want to have addressed. And then at the same time, staring at a budget deficit far beyond anything anyone thought possible.
He's got a bully neighbor to the south of us saying,
yes.
Shore up your border, shore up your immigration. You know, you're not taking anything for free from us anymore.
We still have problems around the world that we're dealing with at the same time.
But those are Bloc and NDP. See, the interesting thing in my mind is those are Bloc and NDP problems now a little bit, right? Because so now he's kind of where before, you know, the Bloc was just trying to get to a provincial election before all the things you mentioned with Otto and other things that were started happening. So they were kind of like, okay, whatever the budget is, we're going to vote it. If it's 60, if it's 70, if it's what, 80,
right.
I don't know if anyone was prepared for $100 billion budget deficit, but you know, the Bloc was kind of like, just get us, you know, they share resources provincially and federally. So they're not equipped for a big election charge on two fronts.
Right.
Because they definitely do not want to lose their hold provincially. So they were just like, okay, whatever happens, we'll vote it through and, you know, let's get the provincial election knocked down, do well in that, and then we'll live to fight another day. That was kind of, but now I think it's kind of positioned them in a weird spot because now, quite frankly, I think they see most of Canada looking at them and probably at home, you know, where in Quebec, they're probably saying, it's a mess. He's at $100 billion. If you concede and vote with him on the budget,
we're going to have a hard time with you provincially and federally.
Exactly. So it's kind of middled them a little. And then if I'm the NDP, Jim and I were talking this before the show, I'm sorry. Like, I would vote not confidence. You got nothing to lose. You don't have official standing.
You don't have a leader.
You don't have a leader. The Liberals are weakened, right? They're, you know, as much as you want to say, dropping this budget and everything happening with auto and aluminum and everything in the world, you know, in tariffs, they probably have an opportunity to pick up more seats and get official standing back.
That's a huge thing financially for the party.
It is. So, you know, sitting there, you're probably like, really weighing your options now and saying, I think if this is a $100 billion deficit budget, I'm probably voting against. And, you know, the only swing vote that comes is the Bloc.
So, and it's easy to vote against a $100 billion deficit, which we're, by the way, hearing now that it's
maybe more,
And, yeah. And also, if you don't mind, I put this out there,
please.
Our sources are telling us that Elections Canada is already bracing for this next election, because this non-confidence vote over a budget is a likelihood, or at least it's a potential that they're getting ready.
Yeah, you have, just in case.
Yeah.
But there's no question that historically, anytime a government releases a budget, there is a huge marketing and publicity blitz on all levels of media and the public to sell the budget to the Canadian people.
Which is interesting. So this is a very interesting, you know, strategically, usually it happens a few weeks out. So by now,
you almost know everything going in. Yeah.
Yeah. See, you know, they release pieces of it. They're very,
they leak the headlines.
They leak it out. It's been kind of quiet.
Yes.
You know, and last week he was still, you know, the prime minister was still canvassing his cabinet, asking them for projects. And there was still a lot of that kind of budget building going on, which traditionally is done already, and they're out kind of moving to do the PR around it before they launch it. So they're a little late out of the gate.
Do you think that he was waiting for good news out of the U.S., like he was going to have a meeting that meant something?
The only thing, I agree, Paul.
Think he thought he was going to get something when he went to the... I really do think he thought that was going to be a more fulsome, developed conversation.
Hold the budget, I got this.
The only sort of budget tease we got was just before we started taping this, basically a Crime and Punishment revival in Canada from Mark Carney, a promise to hire 1,000 more members of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police to change the bail laws if you have a serious crime, which is something people across the country have been crying for. And it steals a lot of thunder away from the Conservatives if he institutes this, because that's stuff they were talking about in the last election.
Well, he does tend to scoop them on some pretty obvious stuff, you know, crime, bail reform. Those are easy things to scoop on, but it does leave the Conservative, at least Polyev, in a position to say, okay, what can I complain about now?
Well, because how can he vote against it? Because he campaigned for it.
Exactly.
No. But he should, and this is kind of, you know, non-political PR, but, you know, the Conservatives should take the hero's walk on this one. So this is one that they should be out front saying, I took the leadership role in, you know, putting the last bill up that you knocked, you know, you voted against. So all parties voted against their legislation on bail reform. And he should go back out and say, if I hadn't done that, it wouldn't have caused you to move faster. And therefore you move faster. And so he should, you know,
I actually think there's credit there. You know, I don't know if they're taking credit for it, but
they will.
You would hope, because that is one of the moments that they actually shone on this front.
Yeah.
But as we take, and I don't know, Nick, if you can pull up the map that we have, it just kind of gives a view of
a country divided.
Well, you could start to see why it was important to start to move some of these ministers around. You know, so much of their weight in Ontario, Quebec, and the Atlantic provinces could easily just slip away, and in undecided or less decisive markets in those places, they could slip away. That majority could slip away.
And on the West Coast, quite frankly, he's still got some challenges, right? So, you know, you look at BC and soft lumber and everything going on out there.
Yes.
You have the energy file, which, you know, they're fighting tooth and nail, the two provinces on. You know, he's going to have some challenges because he's got to pick a side. And, you know, and now there's a lot of, when auto came up in Ontario, and they started to talk about, you know, subsidies for the auto industry, which right now, I think most people know this, but, you know, it's roughly $50 billion a year we do subsidize auto in Ontario or Canada across. So we do spend a lot of money to keep that industry here.
Okay, so we just lost it. Now what do we do with that money, and do we continue to spend it?
Well, that's what the soft lumber guys are saying. Put it into us. But then the question that people are asking right now is, okay, if we put it there, where do you go with it? So what happens? So you can produce more soft lumber, but where's that soft lumber go? And so there's a lot of discussion. Everyone's kind of, you know, out there vying for dollars in the budget, and where do we use them, and how much contingency do we put aside? And he's kind of stuck, right? He's got to say, okay, I got to keep my votes in BC. So I got to put some money down to BC. You know, I need to keep the East Coast.
He's got pressure to spend on NATO.
He's got pressure on NATO. And he's got Ontario, which is kind of falling apart right now. Ontario is kind of crumbling with, you know, you got steel mills, you got auto, you got all the manufacturing bases crumbling.
They're trying to get the Ring of Fire revitalized and get going as fast as possible to make up for it.
But it's not, you know, we all know that's not a liberal initiative, right?
Right. It's going to drag its heels no matter what happens.
That's an old guard versus new guard issue, right? So environmental protections over land and indigenous rights and everything mm-hmm. else are a huge liberal hot point, right? So he's got an old cabinet sitting there, right? You know, he's got Jolie
Champagne.
Yeah, he's got those people sitting there and they're saying, time out, buddy. No way. Like, that's not who we are. You know, we don't go tear up lands and go mining like crazy.
Well, this is my question. So I mean,
that's the hotbed for him.
Absolutely.
Right now.
It's interesting. When we were all chatting before, I raised the question, okay, so he has, Carney has a position where he has all of this Trudeau virtue signaling that's cost so much money, anything from environment to land rights to, you know, carbon tax and all that sort of stuff. Carney's got that already built into the cake. And now he's got other problems that he needs to get out of to keep his stronghold in parts of the country that could shift otherwise.
Yeah. And there's some signaling there'll be another cabinet shift.
Yeah, in a couple of weeks they're saying this.
Is that in order to kind of shore up his party so he can make some of these moves so the dissension isn't too large, right? Because if you leave some of the people in place and they're so against this move that you have to make up to mining and potentially some pipelines, right? You need to then, you know, is that going to splinter his party when he may be going into a non-confidence vote, which would mean he'd be done at that point because, you know, that would hurt him on a number of fronts. Right?
But think about this, gentlemen. So he's going to be dealing with his potential unrest in his own caucus, some upset people in the public, and some very strong, powerful premiers in this country that he's going to have to be dealing with as well.
Yeah.
And Doug Ford and Daniel Smith and Tim Houston and David Eby. And they are really strong, powerful, entrenched premiers who will have a lot of say beyond what happens in Parliament Hill. And that's all stuff he's going to have to deal with.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to hear your premier telling you how to vote in a federal election.
Because you're upset with how you think the budget is for your province.
Right. And you would have very little cause to be quiet on that, because once you hit $100 billion in excess spending that you can see is just meant to keep everybody happy, has long-term, really heavy long-term effects on us as a country.
Franco Tirsano a few minutes ago, right? We're basically up to $50 billion in interest payments on debt so far, right?
So far,
you know, based on our total deficit. And that's going to grow because he's slating, you know, $60+ billion for the next 4 years. So that's going to almost double, right?
Happens to our dollar then?
Well, ultimately our dollar devalues, right? So our dollar devalues, we print more money, our bond ratings go down.
Our interest income is intense.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, and it's, you know, if you look at, you know, I always use Germany as kind of an example of someone who's a little further ahead of us on the scale of diminishment. Then, you know, you really see the devaluation, the unemployment, unfortunately, and then you have to get more government-backed projects. You know, that's why right now that country is, you know, a lot of what they do is arms and defense, because quite frankly, they need to create those projects. To create those jobs. And that becomes...
I know for selfish reasons, as a parent with two daughters in their early mid-20s, the one thing I'm looking at in this upcoming election, youth unemployment, because our family's dealing with it right now.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of young, well-educated, well-trained people who can't find a job in this country.
And even if they weren't trained well, certainly in Ontario, we let a huge amount of training capital and funding just vaporize. So even if there was hope for them to be retrained into something, we've lost auto. Okay. Yeah. Nobody's training into that.
Community colleges have been slashed.
There's absolutely no way that we have the right number of people trained to build the infrastructure that is the housing that we need and these ports and building these ships and stuff like that. It kind of leaves Carney in spending money that goes out of our country into other places for expertise, for resources, for things that we could be supplying ourselves now. That, if there's an election in November, that's going to be rung hard in front of his face, because you can't spend $100 billion of new deficit money to rebuild a country that will take 10 or 15 years to realize on these projects and still look like a good guy at the end of the day.
Well, that's where his back's up against the wall, right? You know, so Jim brought up housing, you know, and Ontario was one of them. They came out the other day and they said they're, I think, 500,000 skilled trades short of even coming close to meeting their goal of housing.
500,000?
So, yeah, it's not even attainable at this point. So, again, you got to you're moving your people around because you're trying to shore up your base. But that's tough because, you know, you have people like, you know, you're talking about your kids and your family. You have people that are saying, well, hey, what are we going to do with them? Where are they going to live? Where are they going to work? You know, those are the challenges you have right now. And you're trying to shore up political zones to get people to tell them something's coming, but you're going to have to spend your way out of it. And you can spend your way. So to your point about, you know, economies, mm-hmm. you can spend your way out of it, because that's pretty much where you're at right now. You got to spend your way out. The challenge is you have to do GDP positive growth projects.
Which is a pipeline.
Which is a pipeline. So whatever you're producing, you're bang on. So you use a pipeline as an example. Whatever's coming out of that pipeline needs to be sold for revenue.
Got it.
Right? So it has to have but it can't be sold to yourself. So you can't do internal projects where you're just like, right. you know, affordable housing.
So you need a tanker going to Germany or a tanker going to Japan.
Exactly. It has to be going somewhere, right? Yeah. So it has to be helping your GDP. And so quite frankly, if you sit down and you create projects to create those goals, now that has a whole bunch of other issues that Canadians are going to face, which, you know, we talked about earlier in another show, but that means people will have to migrate more in Canada, which is like you're talking about your kids, you know, my kids, the day of like kids growing up and staying with you in Toronto, or, you know, when they're getting a job and, you know, you having Thanksgiving and they drive over to your house and your house probably is going to go the way of the bye-bye, right?
Yeah.
So a lot of the people that are working or need work right now will probably have to go north. They'll have to work up in camps and mining camps. They'll have to go west.
It might be shift 1 week on, 1 week off.
Exactly, yeah.
Like we do with oil rigging or other sort of resource mining.
Being so resource heavy, we're going to have to create that, right? And that's, you know, again, backs him into the whole issue of environmental projects and everything else. But we're getting to the point where that decision, like, it's narrowing, right? So that decision is narrowing upon him that he has to make that call. Can he make that call with the existing cabinet?
I would have to think there's a lot of private, intense meetings going on.
Oh, yeah.
From Carney and his most trusted lieutenants sitting down with the Trudeau holdovers and saying exactly what you said, Paul. The only way we get out of this, we have to do this, this, and this. Oh, I know it's not the way we did things, but we'll never get out of it.
But he does have that crowd there, Jim, saying, no, we've already committed to this and this and this.
We can't do that.
And we're not going. So I do think you're right. His backup is up against the wall. With Canadians in general. First of all, his ratings are slipping. Okay.
Still ahead of Polyev, though, I will say.
Yeah. But he does seem to be having this, the sheen is off of.
Well, yes, I agree.
Off the job. And I think some of his travel has led to nothing.
Yeah.
We're looking a little foolish, I think, on the international scene, to be honest with you.
Yeah. Don't, you know, Egypt and, you know, they're calling him the wrong name in Egypt and referring to him as the president of Canada, you know, all that stuff. I get that.
Trump did that.
Yeah.
As well.
He's entering 80, I feel like sometimes I call the cat and the dog in our house the wrong name.
Mr. President?
Yeah, you know, like.
And so, called the cat Mr. President.
So now Trump, yeah, exactly. And so now Trump is acting like a guy about to turn 80 calling someone, are you the president? Or
you know what? I like what he said. He goes, oh, yeah, I did that. I'm sorry about that. At least I didn't call you governor, huh? And he just moved away.
He just kept going.
He laughed. It was funny.
He just bounces. Eh? Nothing bothers him.
No.
But you know, the interesting, you know, part of that whole equation is Carney's got to make a move and figure all this out relatively quickly. So you look at the timeline. So there's the wild part of this, right? Because we're going into the budget, because we have a non-confidence company, he's got a shuffle coming up. So he's I think he hoped when he went to the US, he was coming out with a deal. Because
something to show Canadians and show his caucus.
So let's be serious.
Insert in the budget.
Yes.
Yeah.
Stellantis doesn't just show up the other day and close the plant, right?
Exactly.
So he knows about it 2-3 weeks in advance. Yeah. So, you know, he's going to the U.S., he's sitting down with them, and he's hoping something's coming because he needs it, right? Then he comes back, he didn't get it. Then he goes to Egypt. He doesn't want to go to Egypt's a nice place, but I'm sure he wasn't like that's not
wasn't on his list. I'm sure.
Not a flight.
Well, the armed forces wasn't even ready for it. They didn't even have a plane ready. Like it came out of
he flew commercial.
He didn't even allow any reporters to join him and got in trouble for that.
He took flair.
No, but so he flies over because quite frankly, he needs another conversation.
Yeah. Anything that
like he's not going,
he needs FaceTime.
Yeah, he's using anything to get FaceTime to say, hey, by the way, you know, we didn't talk about
we're going to build that pipeline all the way down to Texas.
And Ford's calling him Trump's calling him the wrong name.
Can I
like go away? and he's like,
they're leaving him out of photo shoots.
Well, he was stuck in the back there with his arms folded while they were signing all the documentation.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and again, I don't think he's there for that. You know, he might be there partially for that, but quite frankly, he's there to have another conversation because he's getting what's coming, right? And it's such a narrow, like if you think about the timeline now, November 4th is just around the corner. Yeah.
Then we're into winter.
Yeah.
And we're into more heating costs and potential climate issues. What if there's a massive storm somewhere that cripples part of the country? That's unforeseen. You can't plan for that.
Exactly. He's trying to get all this knocked down before, and it's not coming. It's not sequencing properly. And,
right.
You know, so therefore, you know, but, and hence, that's why all these political shuffles, so he can hopefully shore up, because he's contingency planning. Maybe it's not going to go the way he wants.
So he delivers the budget, and then you anticipate more ministerial shuffle. Or do we see that?
That's a great question.
Before the budget.
Is it before or after?
Yeah.
Before.
You think there will be the dominoes will fall before?
I think he'll do it before.
Yeah.
Right? Because the fallout of, I think they're having that conversation now. And he's trying to figure out potentially if he drops a certain type of budget, who stays with him.
Who comes up against it?
Yeah, who are you going to stay with me? Like that's that conversation happening now. I'm going this way because I have to go this way.
And he needs ministers and MPs out there selling it hard.
Exactly. So if they're not going to, if they can't get behind it, he doesn't need a lot of people just to walk away. The worst thing could happen for him right now. He strategically moves some people around. He goes to drop the budget and they're like, I don't like this budget.
Couple of people are left over going, I don't know.
And they're not selling it.
No, they're not selling it. They just go back to their ridings and sit quietly, right?
That would
be the whisper campaign,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
You know, the opposition hears tales of unrest.
And then talk to their friends, reporters and columnists and drop a little hints here and there.
Exactly. And then that non-confidence bubble that we talked about starts to bubble up. Mm-hmm. And quite frankly.
And the ridings where it could go either way, start to really shift.
Well, look how many seats in the last election were a coin toss, really.
Yeah.
100 seats either way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Multiple dozens of seats were like that.
It makes me wonder if he delivers a budget, we receive it as Canadians, he's made the shift. All of this looks like we've got a bright, brand new government. We've shifted all of our people into the right place, and now we've got a budget that they can work with.
Right.
That seems to be what the image will be.
If they can get aboard. And then on the other side, you have, you know, you see the Conservatives have now started a couple of days ago with nothing's happened. They're starting their campaign to get ready for the budget. So they're out already. You know, he's doing the interviews, the videos where he's saying, you know, he's been in power. Nothing's happened. We haven't dropped. It's been ineffective. We've done tours, haven't signed deals. Mm-hmm. So they're going to start that ramping up that messaging even harder.
The Bloc
has said some things too.
Yeah, they've been. I'm shocked that the Bloc has come out as early as they have now. And actually, now I know again they're trying to get things in the budget, so they're negotiating. I get that,
but they've been quite strong with their criticism.
I was a little shocked with some of the rhetoric that came out, which I didn't think they would.
We don't go backward ever. So now the largest budget in the history of Canada. Does it ever reduce from this point on?
Well, it didn't. Okay, so we talked about that before. You remember, we were talking about the mid-90s.
Okay, yeah,
And I was just telling the story about how slow it was.
Right.
Right? We were at a $150 billion deficit, and things were really slow. Things got to the point where you go to work and it was painful because it was so unproductive and so little to do. Everyone was just kind of hanging on, waiting for, you know, the shoe to drop. And it really did feel that way for a few years.
It did. You're right. Painful. There was a lot of just trotting along.
Yeah.
Waiting.
And then all of a sudden, you know, there was a like mass restructuring government. Paul Martin, you know, those days came in, restructured everything, got things back on the rails, went down to a $10 billion deficit.
And what period of time, Paul? Was that three years? 3 years.
Three years. Okay.
Yeah, it was a 3 year. I looked at it this morning with
Franco. Okay, so let's say there's a unicorn in the House of Commons working with Paul Martin or Mark Carney. Is it possible to get from the budget we're about to get to 3 years like they did in the 90s?
It is, but remember there was, like, you know, and I probably get the number wrong, but it was, you know, close to 100,000 people laid off in government. Like it was a huge, massive restructuring.
But would this current government get rid of that many civil servants?
No, they're actually looking to increase CRA by a huge amount. That's one of the things.
Because you can't get anybody on the phone.
Well, he's bounced around a little, right?
To chase people for the money they owe.
Yeah, the prime minister's bounced around a little. You know, originally he said yes, he was going to do a major restructuring. Then he went to just, you know, he was going to give packages and slowly wind people out. I'm not sure where they're going. Again, that I think that's part of the conversation he's having within his own cabinet and caucus. He's trying to figure out
where they're going to get the money
and
what can they cut.
Well, and also who's potentially at risk. You remember these are massive unions.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Right? So powerful.
Yeah, these are powerful unions they go up against. So like, you know, we tell the Paul Martin story, but they have consequences, right? So as soon as you do those things, you know, you kind of last for a while. But eventually it comes to bite you, right? Because they're mad, right?
They shift the vote of their union members.
Yeah,
and,
they're large blocks. Yeah.
And then the NDP and Jack Layton rose and rose on the heels of that, did they not?
Yeah, remember the whole where that all came to be? And so, you know, that's the power shift that happened. So, you know, that's the, you know, the joy of politics is what he's in the middle of. You know, your back is going against the wall and your next move, it could be your last.
It just feels to me, and maybe I don't understand this properly, but it feels to me that he's going to try to spend his way out based on trying to keep everything in place that the Trudeau government put into place, which was, in some cases, bloated spending and programs that don't necessarily make sense. Depending on who you are, you might have a different opinion. But he's got all of that commitment that Trudeau, just basically on the way out the door, everybody hates me anyway. I'm going to, and it just seemed to me like all of these programs, fat cat programs, got fatter. He's got that to deal with. He's got to contend with Canadians that can't get homes, can't get health care, are having a hard time getting their kids
employed.
He's
got to deal with Trump.
Yeah. That's right. He's got all of these variables playing against him now. That almost leads me to think the only thing he can do is spend his way out at our expense.
Yeah, you will try again, spend your way out. But, you know, how he spends his way out and how he gets growth out of spending his way out is the key. Mm-hmm. And I don't doubt that he will. Like, I think pretty much 100% the deficit's going to go up. They are going to try and they're going to try to hop it. The key now, it's like Trump, you know, this is an interesting discussion because, you know, he thinks tariffs bringing manufacturing home will do him well. He'll get people to go back into factories. I said from day one, I don't think that has a shot at all. I'll be totally, I've said that on a number of shows. I think I lived in the U.S. for quite some time. I think getting Americans and young kids from, you know, past generations to come and go back into the manufacturing lines of America is highly unlikely.
It's tough work. Yeah. It's not for everybody, Paul.
No, and it's hard on the mind. It's hard on the soul. And I think kids today have a little more holistic, you know, organic view of life, quite frankly, the way they want to live it.
You can't be on your phone while you're trying to weld a car's engine together. Exactly.
You can, but you might take your colleague's eye out.
Yeah. So I you know, so now
those are not desirable jobs to the kids we've raised in this country. No.
Yeah. So now we have a little bit of the same issue if you think about it, because now in order for us to spend our way out of it with projects that have GDP growth, mm-hmm. we'd have to create jobs that produce something. So jobs that produce something tend to be manual. So whether you're going to mining or whether you're going to a pipeline or whether you're, you know, you can do AI and you can have IT and all those things, they're all great. But, you know, a lot of them, quite frankly, we've hit the bubble of that. You know, I think the tech we still have AI and everything, and that'll reduce labor, and there'll be some work in that structure and that industry. But a lot of what we need to do in Canada will pretty much be hard manual labor that people will have to go do. So then they'll have to move, they'll have to relocate or go to a town, work for a few weeks and come back. And the challenge will be, are Canadians ready to put that? Because, you know, back in, I don't know, in the mid 90s, if you guys remember it, I remember working pretty damn hard.
Same.
Yeah. So like as a young man, I remember, quite frankly, you know, my days were damn long. Mm-hmm. I worked really hard and my employer worked me really, really hard. And
because you didn't have a choice.
No, and I didn't. I didn't.
No. They all in the same boat. Yeah.
If you said no, the next person was ready to take
the spot. And they'd gladly do it.
Yeah. So there wasn't a lot of options. And so we're kind of getting into that spot again where, but
why are we in that spot? We're one of the most resource rich countries on earth. Take a look at other resource rich countries. Are they worried about their labor force having to become part of their economy? No.
Norway isn't.
No, look no. at, I mean, I,
but that's
I,
a cultural shift, right? They embraced their resource rich environment, and they created a work ethic of people who enjoyed and took pride in doing it.
And Norway now is set up with different levels of society, from being an infant to a senior citizen, you're taken care of.
Yeah.
Well, that's because of the work ethic, the way they were able to structure themselves. And we didn't, right? We kind of, you know, we had low birth rates. We had, you know, medium unemployment. We tried to do tech crisis. We had poor immigration policies. We did it. We thumped it pretty hard on the, you know, doing a lot of really wrong things for a while. And quite frankly, that came back, you know, to bite us. And so now the shift is where we're going to have to, but same as the US, we're going to have, in order to get those GDP growth projects, we're going to have to convince people
to take these kind of jobs
and that it's worth doing. And that's the only option.
Some of those jobs are well worth it though.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. But gentlemen, Paul, you just nailed it. We'll have to convince people that what we heard the last 10, 12 years, we're going to have to put that aside for now for the good of the country. We're going to have to build the pipeline and do this and do that. And things that we were told were not good, now they're going to have to be good. Otherwise, we won't have the money in the GDP to pay down and pay for everything.
And the people that are going to do it we have to tell them that there's no option. They have to go do it. Yeah. So that's, you know, and that's the challenging part, you know, because we, for a while there on our education, we brought everyone in, we educated everyone, you know, free education is our culture. So we pretty much, the people who lived here got very low cost education. People who came in paid a lot of money, but they paid it because they wanted to immigrate here.
Right.
But we've done a good job at educating people. Now we have to say to them, okay, you need to roll up your sleeves and go, you know, you got a decade of really hard labor before you maybe get to the promised land and do the trade you wanted.
Well, I will say, as a parent who had two kids in university, that's not free.
Yeah,
right.
But now, you know, they went through, the, you know.
But also, are they prepared to go get work on the line for the next 10 years of their life?
None of them studied anything remotely like that.
Well, we don't need them to study. We just need them to show up. We'll train them. But we need them to be here 8 hours a day on this line, pulling this resource.
That's a tough ask for a lot of Canadian young people.
But it's a generational shift. You know, and I tell this story all the time. My dad had a cartage company, right? So we moved furniture, right? So when I went to go to university, being a new immigrant to Canada, his first thing, he thought it was insane that I wanted to go to university. So he did everything he could to get me not to go to school.
Because why wouldn't you do what I did?
Well, he wanted to buy another truck.
Right.
And he wanted another truck on the road making money all day. So he wanted me working in the business, making money. Last thing he wanted to do was subsidize a kid to go to university because he didn't see any value in it.
Right? Yeah.
So now the shift is so that, you know, I had to, we were overcoming that, right? We were kind of like people who are kind of hot and cold on education. Yeah, if you want to go. But, you know, for the most part, you know, get a job. So now we're going to have to reverse some of that thinking. And that's going to be like the U.S. That's some of the challenges we're going to encounter.
A university education is amazing, but it's funny how many, the percentage of my own children that got a university education and then had to go for more practical training from the college system.
Yeah.
You know, so it's we made it a two-tier program for these kids. Let me ask you guys as we wrap here. First of all, do you think the budget is more or is $100 billion or more?
More. I'm up around, but if you add in defense, I think you're probably closer to, depending on whether we do the Golden Dome or whether we just go on our own, you're somewhere between 125 and 150 billion.
Second question, does Carney clean up his cabinet to back this and promote it properly? Does he get it done in time? And do you think the public receives it well based on his shuffle?
He will do it because he has to do it. And I don't think it will be perceived well. Initially, and they'll have to use everything in their power to sell it so it is perceived well.
Yeah.
No, I don't think he'll clean it up in time. I don't think he can get the old guard out. So I'm a little different. But yeah, I think he's going to struggle. He's had timeline issues from day one. He set goals. One of the challenges I think he's finding in government, similar to a lot of people who have their first term in government who come from the business sector. In the business sector, you send your business plan, you know, it's up to you. You get up every morning and you march as fast as you can because you have resources to do it. In government, there's so many factions resisting against you. And I think that's kind of the challenge he's having right now. He has all these factions around him. He's trying to figure out where they stand. In politics, it's hard to figure out where anyone stands.
So true.
Therefore, struggling a little.
Think about his background. Goldman Sachs, yeah. Brookfield Management, yeah, the great. Bank of England, the Bank of Canada.
Yeah.
He got things done and had people, and he would say, this has got to be done this day, and things happened.
Yes, sir. How fast?
Right.
Yeah.
And he had a whole team of people
now
doing
that.
Now he's
dragging Santa's sled
behind.
Now he's
dealing with reluctant premiers and the Privy Council and this and that.
Who does it sound like? Trump in his first term.
Right.
Remember?
Yeah, right. He had to drag a lot of people around.
He didn't understand. He went to Washington and he just didn't understand.
And everything's slow and there's all these layers and
you don't know who's zooming who and why and
right.
Yeah, and he's going through that, right? He's been there, like he spent time with Trudeau, but it's one thing to be behind the scenes, it's another thing to be in charge, right?
And then in Ottawa, all of a sudden there's a coffee shop or a place where they, you know, a little dive bar. And there is a disgruntled member of the Liberal caucus siling up to a reporter telling some gold while they have a coffee or a drink and letting them know because they're not happy. But they'll be more than happy to tell you or you what's not going on right.
It's so funny. I was at an event on the weekend and former Privy Council Deb Schultz for the Liberal Party was
there. Brilliant woman.
Actually, one of the greatest in my life in politics and just part of the community. One of the good ones.
Mm-hmm.
But it was interesting because I said to her, as we're doing what we're doing, I go in with a very distinct opinion. I'm going to be angry at Mark Carney today about this, and I'm going to be mad at Pierre Poilievre about that. And her response was, but the more you ask, the more you see these layers, the slippery layers and the slimy layers you have to get through.
Yes.
And that picture is a lot for somebody to deal with, I think, who comes from the business community.
And had things done. Yeah. Mark Carney needed something done, it got done. And it was like that his whole business career. Because
I'm the prime minister and I want an apple. Bring it to my office immediately. How long? 8 months?
Right.
It'll have to be a pear? Oh my God. Yeah.
Seriously, Paul, you make a good point. This is a real life adjustment form as someone who spent the last 35 years working one way and now things are done completely different.
Oh yeah.
Within government.
Look at, you know, on the U.S. front, right? How many timelines? And, you know, and I sympathize because I can only imagine, because if I tried to do the same thing, I think I'd be totally frustrated. But, you know, he went to the U.S. He thought he had a deal 4 or 5 times, right? And he left.
Yeah.
And, you know, now he's dealing with a guy who, quite frankly, is in his second term. He's wheeled many deals on the political side now.
Yeah.
Probably seen he's seen the inside of Washington. He's not in no hurry. He's going to just move him around.
One last question. Do we have an election in November? What do you think?
No.
50-50.
I think it's 50-50.
I'm 50-50 right now. Okay. I was probably 80-20. I think as we're seeing things unfold, I'm getting to the 50-50.
So yeah, it seems like
I'm flipping a coin on this one now.
It feels like enough.
I'm sure a lot of people in Ottawa agree with you both.
Well, apparently Elections Canada is looking into it, so doing what they have to do. Guys, thank you for the discussion on this. I really appreciate it. Don't forget, subscribe, like, make comments. We love your comments, even the nasty ones. They're fine. And we would love to get you in on the discussion with us. Visit tplmedia.ca for all the content to subscribe, to support the show. You can do that on all the platforms. Thanks. We'll see you next time.
See ya.